Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchuk. In this episode, we'll hear a monologue about the future of media in the wake of the crisis in American broadcast television in 2009 and beyond. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a selection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Public media is the most trusted source of news in both the United States and in Great Britain. And yet, public media institutions are fighting for their lives. Both PBS and NPR in the States and BBC across the pond are being challenged by economic and political pressures, a rapidly changing journalism landscape, and technological innovations that are transforming the way people view news. This week, leading figures in public media and journalism discussed the new challenges and innovations in public media at a panel sponsored by Free Press and the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. Mark Thompson, director of the BBC.
Public broadcasting is founded on a belief in public space. In other words, on the belief that there's room for a place which is neither part of the state nor purely governed by commercial considerations, in which everyone is free to enter and within which they can encounter culture, education, debate, where they can share and swap experiences.
But the idea of public space is being challenged, especially on the web, where commercial interests are trying to monetize the internet. Thompson says that public media can combat those forces because of its mission of inclusion and access.
In fact, it seems to me that digital media and its open, democratizing spirit represent an almost perfect fit with what I mean by the term public space. And that if the BBC and other public broadcasters can migrate safely and successfully into this new world, that far from slipping to the edge, to the peripheral vision of our audiences, our eye and ear contact with them can grow deeper and more valuable.
PBS President Paula Kerger said public media can excel in areas where commercial media has fallen down. News and information, cultural arts, and educational and children's programming. Collaboration with other organizations to partner together to make media that will serve the public and create new avenues for funding is necessary for success.
If we don't take the opportunity now to really try to build out some of those partnerships and think about some of the new ways that we can move forward and look at the new ways of bringing in funding, including government funding, we will have indeed lost a moment.
To watch the entire panel discussion on public media in a digital age, go to newpublicmedia.org.
In an age when consumers can mute and fast-forward commercial breaks, advertisers are looking for ways to sell products where people are least expecting it, embedded into local news broadcasts. The problem is, there is no way for viewers to tell the real news from the fake news. Last week, Free Press filed a letter asking the FCC to put an end to fake news. Fake news is a way to sneak paid advertising into a news broadcast by dressing it up as real news. It takes many different forms, from prepared stories called video news releases that are created by PR firms, to live interviews with so-called experts who are never identified on air as paid spokespeople for certain products or companies. Libby Reinisch, program coordinator with Free Press.
One particularly bad example is a local CBS affiliate that aired a segment entitled CBS Health Watch, in which the station's news reporters interviewed local hospital officials on cancer treatments. In fact, that news segment was part of a series of paid medical advertisements sponsored by the hospital in question.
The letter comes on the heels of an LA Times investigation that found fake news being aired without disclosure all over the country. Viewers are led to believe they're watching a genuine news segment, but are actually watching a hidden advertisement. The letter urges the FCC to investigate new instances of fake news, conclude its review of pending complaints, and put new rules on the books that would require stricter and more prominent disclosure of paid spots.
The evidence in that expose made it clear that instances of fake news are on the rise, and now is the time for the FCC to take action to enforce the rules it has and create stricter rules to protect consumers from fake news. Viewers deserve to know when someone's paying to persuade them.
Reinisch said that fake news is more prevalent now than ever thanks to media consolidation, which has gutted newsrooms. Crippled by job cuts, local stations no longer have the capacity to produce real news, but often turn to fake news to fill broadcast gaps. But fake news, said Reinisch, undermines the basic function of broadcasters to serve the public interest.
The news is a public service, not the commercial break before the commercial break. We depend on our news to uphold principles of independence, credibility, and accuracy in reporting. And fake news makes it impossible to trust our news sources. Our news shouldn't come from a PR firm.
For more information, visit savethenews.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
A rally for jobs, justice, and education that occurs only 2 years after the election of a president and party who apparently cannot deliver either, and which blames not the party in power for those 2 years, but only the fringe elements of the out-of-power right wing, is a rally that even with a George Clinton performance is one nation under no groove, only a grip. And this grip of the Democrats is no soft hold. It is a death grip. It is a stranglehold designed to squeeze the life out of progressive elements within their own party and throughout the rest of the country, indeed the world. In what is being heralded as a largely successful mobilization of a young, energetic, diverse movement led by unionized labor and civil rights organizations was really a carefully manicured slap in the face of those traditions of struggle. Rather than the traditions of each, which include bold, strong, irreverent, organized acts of disobedience, today's versions are safely cajoled spokespersons of the liberal element of the ruling elite. For those who have been coming to Washington, D.C. for decades to attend these kinds of rallies, there was absolutely nothing new. First and foremost is that it was yet another march in D.C. that had nothing to do with the immediate concerns of most of the residents of D.C. Secondly, there were the same tributes to organized religion, pledges of allegiance to the United States, and a choir-styled national anthem meant to convey a fraudulent grassroots image and inclusion of the black working class. But mostly it was the same in that it held out no real challenge to power, no threat of a push against liberalism or conservative democratry. There were the regular co-opted calls of power to the people, quotes referencing A. Philip Randolph's that enemies of health care, education, and jobs are enemies of the Negro, comparisons made between the Tea Party and the old Dixiecrats, and even an extended reading by several young people of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. But there was only scant reference of King's own disillusion with his dream or the fact that the Dixiecrats of old are the Democrats of today and that these are still the enemies of the Negro. But worst of all was the consistent and clear message that the problems we face today are the result of 40 senators and a rabid right wing of the country whose persistent responses of no have held back our innocent, even heroic, current president. The calls for jobs, peace, health care, and education were simply hollow, given that the president all of these people elected has done nothing to advance any of these issues in ways that did not more so advance the interests of the very entities who benefit by the currently horrible conditions of each. The proud traditions of labor and human rights struggles in this country and around the world are disrespected by a leadership that simply says to vote for the Democrat who will beautify our oppression rather than end it. The argument coming loud and clear from the podium Saturday was simply that if you don't again vote for the Democrats and Obama, then there was no point in having voted for them in the first place. There was no point then, and there is no point now. A banker's party is a banker's party, no matter the color or the gender of the candidate. There was one white man I heard this weekend who seems to have not completely lost his mind. David Swanson of the Progressive Democrats of America actually called for us to devalue the role of elections and the presidency itself by massive, even disruptive civil disobedience and grassroots organization. He is absolutely correct. Calls that we vote specifically because of the lives given toward achieving that right usually miss the point of what those fighting for the vote actually wanted that exercise to deliver. Marches that only belatedly call for the elected to deliver that which their benefactors have assured they cannot are simply foolish. New directions with newly developed methods of popular and public challenges are needed. For in the end, Dick Gregory was right. By consistently voting for the lesser of evil and by never seeking the truth about the assassinations of people we march in honor of, we follow the path that leads us to Nazis. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Jared Ball. Visit us online at blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature a monologue about the future of media in the wake of the crisis in American broadcast television in 2009 and beyond. The following monologue was recorded on Saturday, October 9th, 2010. This monologue is an extension, or a part two of sorts, of a monologue that aired on the Ministry of Truth in 2009. For the episode that aired September 10, 2009, monologue on the 2009 crisis in American broadcast television, I had basically laid down the gauntlet for handling a kind of post-broadcasting arrangement in American broadcasting. I always listed it on my list of things to do as new licenses post-cable. Let me explain a little bit of what's going on. And in fact, actually, let me read to you a brief summary that I actually gave as a presentation at the Media Democracy Day Chicago event in 2009. Commercial television broadcasting profits have dramatically fallen in the past year, more like in the last 2 years by now, to the point where major media outlets have begun questioning the idea of even continuing commercial broadcast TV. The beginning of the end may happen soon. Comcast is currently in talks to acquire NBC Universal, and with NBC in fourth place in the ratings, Comcast, if it completes the buyout, could make NBC just another cable channel. And if Comcast does that, CBS might soon follow. The end result? What's been called free TV might disappear altogether in the coming decade, so anyone in America who watches TV would have to pay for it. But this fact can be the linchpin of a nonprofit TV sector in America. After all, we're paying for TV, so why shouldn't we have our money go to broad-based public service broadcasting in the United States and have more of a say in our media, rather than to private, unaccountable fiefdoms in the cable, satellite, and telecom industries? Now, there's a lot that was read there, and I'll take some time now to unpack some of the more controversial points, or at least those points that might not be so controversial, but at least require a little bit of explanation. For one, the future of broadcast television. At the time I gave this presentation, there was a little bit of a question as to whether or not that was as widely known. I think it's actually gained a little bit more traction. I mean, it's to the point now where colleagues of mine at work will sometimes make jokes about the future of broadcast TV. Many people might not feel that way, or at least might not be aware of the terrain in which broadcasting television finds itself now in. And this is worth reiterating and explaining a little bit more. I'll read a portion of a blog post that was actually written on the Chicago Media Action website at chicagomediaaction.org, with the post, "Are America's Media Dying?" is the title, dated March 1st, 2009. A little bit dated, but still bears mentioning. Still a lot of what I have to say here still holds muster. "It would appear that America's newspaper industry is facing troubled times. Consider, the Minneapolis Star Tribune has filed bankruptcy. The owning company of the Philadelphia Inquirer and Philadelphia Daily News filed for bankruptcy. Hearst is threatening to close down the San Francisco Chronicle. E.W. Scripps has closed down the Rocky Mountain News after nearly 150 years. And the Chicago Tribune filed for bankruptcy." In fact, after more than 2 years, the Tribune is still mired in bankruptcy proceedings, and could well be for some time. "Despite the seeming trend of the internet and the lousy economy delivering a 1-2 punch to America's newspapers, we commented back when the Tribune filed for bankruptcy that the newspaper industry was still profitable. As FCC Acting Chair Michael Kopp said, newspaper profits are about double the S&P 500 average, and Gannett leaked profitable numbers. And now we hear from advertising agent analysis that spans the disconnect between a profitable industry and increasing newspaper bankruptcies. It's not the newspapers, it's their debt-laden owners. To quote from the article, publicly owned newspapers averaged an operating profit of 10.8% in the first three quarters of last year. That's not the margin enjoyed by newspapers when they were monopolies, but it's not nothing either. The owners, on the other hand, are variously posting huge losses, at least on paper, watching their stock prices plunge, and, crucially, struggling to make payments on debt they took under projections that didn't pan out. But while the newspaper industry is delivering mixed signals, one major industry which might well be on the brink is broadcast television. Here the signals in recent weeks and months are clear. All hell is breaking loose. Advertising on broadcast TV has taken a nosedive, and with little else in the way of income, there is talk in recent weeks in the media business press of what was considered unthinkable just a few months ago. Broadcast networks could leave behind local stations for cable. If that were to happen, local broadcast TV affiliates, who relied on networks for filling in a good chunk of their airtime, might face an otherwise unfillable gap and even disappear. This would dramatically change the calculus on media in Chicago and in the United States in at least two directions. Direction number one. On the digital television front, it could well be the case that broadcast analog television in the United States wouldn't be able to reach poorer communities, as we've long been saying, not because of poor outreach or any of a host of problems with digital converter boxes, but instead because broadcast television, digital or analog, will no longer exist. Direction number two. Since broadcast television in the United States would no longer exist, it would be the case that you'd have to pay to watch television. What's been called free TV would disappear, but then so would the policy rationale supporting so-called free TV. That is, it's basically seen as a kind of leveling influence that whoever has a TV can watch it regardless of their political or economic standing in society. The richest people as well as the poorest people in the United States can still get the same channels. That was supposedly a big rationale for broadcast television, basically built around a commercial model, but that would obviously no longer be the case should broadcast television disappear. Thus, we should ask, why shouldn't we have a TV licensing scheme in the United States? After all, we're paying for television anyway, and it's our money, so why shouldn't we have our money go to well-funded, broad-based public service broadcasting in the United States and have more of a say in where our dollars go, rather than to private unaccountable fiefdoms in the cable, satellite, and telecom industries? You can see that the message is something of a repetition, but it bears repeating, especially since the message within the major media culture is all but absent. One point regarding the Comcast buying of NBC Universal, that's currently underway now. A lot of analysts think that might be a done deal. I actually think that it's not as cut and dried as many people would think. There's been a lot of skepticism about whether or not the deal will actually go through. I'm actually thinking one possible reason it may get scuttled is because it may actually just take too long, and promises that Comcast made to their investors might cause a revolt among investors who might call them to call it off, and it might get called off. So it might not be as cut and dried or as a done deal as many people may think. That might be a topic for another time. But nonetheless, we're seeing this trend about broadcast television disappear. Where do we go next should that happen? Or what should be the kind of policy decisions or policy directions that we should call for? And that's basically what I'd like to spend the balance of this time, having set the terrain of the land here. Where do we go from here? What should we call for next? And what would be the kinds of things that we should advocate for? Well, one thing is, if cable is going to be the dominant means by which television will be broadcast, although internet television may be a way by which people may receive media, and television might be basically an appendage of the internet, if that were to be the case, and for many people that's actually the case now. But nevertheless, where we go from here and how might the policy directions here proceed in that regard? Well, one way in which, if cable is going to be the dominant mechanism by which people will get television, or perhaps even much if, or a good chunk of their major media, local franchise laws by which local cable operations can happen would need to be changed. And this would actually be a very tough policy fight, especially given the increasing growing lobbying influence that cable companies have in the political sphere, certainly in Washington, D.C. at the federal level. There, the major lobby is the NCTA, the National Cable Telecommunications Association. They are very notorious for playing hardball, and they get their way a lot of the time. There won't be an easy enemy to fight. In fact, actually now, the longtime boogeyman regarding broadcast media and lobbying force, the National Association of Broadcasters, might become something of a muted kitten compared to the lobbying weight that cable may now wield, never mind technologies that might actually extend from the internet vis-a-vis media. That would be basically one terrain of struggle to fight on, changing franchise laws so that a portion of the money, maybe even a good chunk of it, most of it, who knows, maybe even all of it, would go from those private hands, for the most part, into public media. Now, to be sure, in some communities, in fact, in a lot of communities, and to a small extent, that's actually what we have now. That's actually how, for example, public access television in Chicago and across the United States for a good portion of cable subscribers is funded. It's actually a portion of that franchise fees from cable companies actually goes to pay for the channels, the infrastructure, the staffing of public access channels, where there are channels that still have channels, access, and funding. This has actually been a terrain of struggle over the last 5-odd years, where laws have actually been changed to actually mute a lot of the influence and a lot of the presence and, in fact, money for funding that. But those laws can be changed, and you're seeing a little bit of a direction that the laws, maybe locally, perhaps nationally, might be trending back in that direction. But that would be one terrain to fight for. What we would do with that money would then be to hopefully ramp up a public media sector in the United States. This is actually the subject of a recent book that's been published that we've actually discussed and actually had a presentation by two authors who I've known for many years and who I count as allies in a struggle regarding media. Bob McChesney and John Nichols. Bob McChesney is on the faculty at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. John Nichols, who lives in Madison, Wisconsin, is a longtime journalist with the Madison Capital Times and with The Nation magazine. They co-wrote a number of books, one of their more recent ones, The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. In this book, they actually outline in more specific detail what they would be calling for as far as the kind of new public service media and the ways to fund that as far as their vision of it. They're kind of approaching it more from a line of the failure of journalism, which we had touched on earlier regarding the collapse of newspapers left and right across the United States and the precarious situation that a lot of newspaper, that the newspaper industry basically finds itself in now. I'm kind of approaching it from a perspective of television, especially broadcast television, finding itself increasingly unprofitable and profit-centered entities kind of veering away from that. But nonetheless, it turns out that from both of these directions, we're arriving at the same more or less goal or suggested policy changes where we would fight for. To quote from Bob McChesney in a speech that he gave on Democracy Now! Earlier in the year when he was interviewed about the book, "The business model that has supported journalism for the last 125 years in this country is disintegrating. There will be some advertising, but much less. There will be some circulation revenues, but much less. And if we're going to have journalism in this country, it's going to require that there be public subsidies to create an independent, uncensored, non-profit, non-commercial news media sector. I would certainly advocate that and certainly support that and calls for that in the policy sphere. And there are policy choices as far as specific laws and regulations to fight for, to help to make that happen. This is outlined some in the book. I've talked about this on the Ministry of Truth. We won't necessarily go into too much of that. What I would go for, as far as the television aspect of this, would be a number of things. One would be to, in addition to taking this money, basically use them to ramp up a nonprofit public media sector of broadcasters in the United States. In the United States, that's basically been, for the most part, for the last 40 years or so, the public broadcasting service, PBS, for television, and National Public Radio, NPR, for radio. Problem is that they've, in a lot of ways, been muted as far as the kind of message, and certainly as far as the kind of money that is concerned. As public media institutions worldwide go, they have been grossly underfunded compared to their counterparts in other countries on a per capita basis. Something like the BBC in Britain, or the CBC in Canada, or the ABC in Australia. Those are major public services that reach a good chunk of the population that have a per capita funding far dwarfing that for PBS and NPR. One statistic I remember hearing is that PBS and NPR, in an annual basis, get about as much funding from the government as ESPN, a single cable channel, from cable fees that ESPN gets over just the course of 2 months. And that's just one cable channel. Never mind all of the litany of cable channels that one can find on cable subscriptions across the United States. obviously that money would need to be ramped up, but so I think would need to be the political structure and I think the kind of ethos about thinking that those media basically only get what the major commercial media can't make any money off of. And that, for the most part, has basically been what PBS and NPR has basically been, the kind of ugly stepsister of American media, that they only get the stuff that is inherently unpopular or that the major media the commercial broadcasters can't make money off of. And I think that's got to change. And I think that some ways of affecting that, not only affecting the political structure by providing that kind of money, insulating outside influence so that commercial resources are basically struck out from the equation or at least muted as far as their potential influence. But also that will bring in the kind of expectation that, yes, you should be able to see major sports on public media or have freewheeling debates involving a great many political candidates from across the political spectrum, not just limiting ourselves to Republicans and Democrats every time. Or having serious investigative journalism regarding centers of power, not just government institutions, but also major corporate institutions and violations that they have, especially these days. So that PBS and NPR wouldn't just be the ugly stepsisters of media, but they or maybe some successor institution or institutions, and not just these big-name national-scale institutions, but also parallel and layered institutions at the local local levels, at regional levels, and even at the national levels that would be able to provide a variety of media for Americans to be able to learn about their world and be able to have more of a say where they can hear thoughts that heretofore had been excluded out because of commercial pressures. Now, given the environment regarding at least corporate efforts in the United States, or certainly anti-corporate efforts that we've been seeing as gaining increasing, if not prominence, probably awareness in the United States in recent years, this would probably be an extension of that. It might even be coupled with it so that efforts to help to promote an anti-corporate media might also be part of an effort to help to oppose corporations and the influence that they wield on practically everything in American life and maybe even world life more generally. Now, there's one problem with that is that that kind of oppositional effort to try to build some kind of framework itself is kind of not anchored in something that I would necessarily consider to be terribly solid. This would require then, in my opinion, a kind of opposition that's rooted in a kind of maybe even anti-market framework. And this is, in most of American media or in public life, this is considered to be just way off base as far as the kind of thing that you can talk about, at least as far as formal institutions go. But nonetheless, the debates like this, I think, are necessary, especially where corporations kind of can be thought of as the political economic equivalent of a shark, and markets kind of serve as the water by which those sharks can survive and thrive. If you drain the water by which those sharks can't thrive, they would very quickly die. But the question there is, what would you put in their place? What would be the kind of economic institutions by which people can have a say in their lives, by which major corporate influences that kind of remove, that kind of accumulate power and remove people generally from the say in which they go, in which directions happen, in which actions can take place? What would be the success, what would be the replacement there? That's a debate that I would not leave here. I actually have discussed this on previous episodes of the Ministry of Truth, and you can go to my website at szcz.org and look up some of the discussions I've had and presentations that have aired regarding various models of political economy outside of either the command planning economies that we've seen, like for example in the old Soviet Union, or the kind of market economies that, for example, we have here in the United States. One model that I've advocated for and have kind of spoken on behalf of has been a model of what's called participatory economics, and people can look that up and go online or check out any books like Par-Econ, A Life After Capitalism by Michael Albert, or Economic Justice and Democracy by Robin Hanel, or a book which I actually had the good fortune to contribute to called Real Utopia, edited by Chris Spanos, to discuss more of those efforts of what kind of economic framework could we have instead. in wrapping up, I would basically say that one critical thing about where we go from here and how we should proceed on this front should be to make this an issue. And that's going to require not only a lot of work, but also a lot of outreach. I'm very lucky that I can help to produce a radio program by which I have a say on this, in which people can learn about this and can hopefully spread the word about this further. I'm more than happy to serve as a conduit in this regard. And I would hope that this can light a fire by which other people can then run with that torch, to kind of drag out an extended metaphor. But the idea would be clear that these issues need to be discussed, they need to be debated, they need to be made issues of, by which people can work on them, can discuss them, can promote them, and which even maybe someday politicians can run on, or lose votes on, or win votes on one or another candidate or candidatorial issue on this front. It's a long way as far as what I was starting this discussion regarding cable television, broadcast television, and media generally. But I think in a lot of ways they're not all that far removed, and we've seen connections here, and it's important, I think, to continue to discuss and work on. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.